All right. Well, thanks a lot. It's great to be here, and I'm learning a lot of new things in this conference. So thanks to the organizers for putting together a very interesting set of speakers. So let me begin by just some broad perspective of the kind of problems that we've been working on. So if you take canonical problems in quantum many-body theory maybe 20 years ago, they're built on two important foundations. One is the idea that you can think of the many-electron or the many-body quantum ground state as just smoothly connected to some simple product state of the particles. And furthermore, this idea of smooth connection applies not just to the ground state, but also to the excited state. So the excited states of a non-interacting system would be particles and holes. But in an interacting system, you still have long-lived excitations with essentially the same quantum numbers. They have a more complicated wave function, but in many respects for experiments, you can just think of them as non-interacting particles. So these are the two pillars from which much of solid-state physics has very successfully explained many, many experiments. So of course, we're interested in going beyond this. And much of the work in the last 10, 15 years has been really built upon destroying the first assumption, which is that your many-body ground state is smoothly connected to some simple product state. And here, the example number one would be the fractional quantum Hall state, where the Laughlin wave function is certainly not smoothly connected to any product state of particles. And it has what we call today a subtle form of long-range quantum entanglement. But even for this state, the idea of the quasiparticle still holds. The excitations are ordinary particles in the sense they look like particles that move along some space-time trajectory. Of course, they have rather exotic quantum numbers, fractional charges, and so on. And in some cases, they may be very important to account for emergent gauge fields, charges that they may carry. And there are many examples of this in some in experiments and computer studies, and we also have a very powerful and well-developed theory of such states relating them to topological quantum field theory. So this is not what I'm going to talk about. Another regime where we've gone beyond the simple product paradigm is in one dimension. So we take electrons in one dimension, in wires or in nanotubes and various other systems. We know that they form a rather non-trivial state, which ultimately for this audience would be some set of conformal field theories in two space-time dimensions. But CFT2s, as we've learned in other talks, are rather special. And they do have, for many properties, what in effect amounts to a quasiparticle basis. For the electron gas, these are basically various sound modes, which can be used to build up the full spectrum of the system and computed specific heat and also many of the transport properties. So the one-dimensional case is somewhat intermediate then, where the quasiparticle picture does fail in some respects for certain operators, but really you can just extend it sufficiently to compute almost everything you want. So finally, sorry. Yeah, all right, but let me not go into that. Yes, so I carefully said what I wanted to say there. All right, but what we want to do is really destroy the second pillar too. We want to talk about systems where you have very complicated many-body ground states with long-range entanglement, and there is no quasiparticle basis for low-energy physics. And thinking theoretically, actually, there's only, as far as we know, two examples of systems that do this. This is the complete list, really. The first example is something, of course, we've heard a great deal about in this conference, which are conformal field theories in higher than one spatial dimension. Of course, there are certain free examples that I'm going to exclude, but if you take an interacting conformal field theory, from a physical point of view, it's a quantum state which does not have a quasiparticle basis. Meaning that when you perturb it, you do not see particles coming out as you see at the LHC. You see some diffuse set of excitations, and we want to understand what the dynamics of those excitations are. Now, we've also had in several talks various no-go theorems about, you know, the only fixed points are conformal fixed points, really. And those are generally true. But there is one example that's emerged from condensed matter over the last 10, 15 years and with better and better understanding of a strongly interacting field theory, which is not conformal in the conventional sense. And it also doesn't have this dynamical exponent z equals 1, so it's not relativistic at all. But it's still strongly interacting. And really, there's essentially one or maybe two examples, depending how you define it, of this. And that turns out to be, we believe, experimentally very relevant. And I'll come to that in the second part of my talk, but probably won't have enough time to do it any justice. So that's going to be the two sets of problems I'll talk about. First, I'll just talk about conformal field theories. How they appear and have appeared in some experiments now in higher dimensions, and what are the kind of properties for such quantum field theories that we'd like to understand. And so that's be the main part of my talk, and hopefully there'll be time then to talk about this non-conformal, non-relativistic, strongly coupled field theory that many of us are working on, and say a few things about it. Okay, so the first part I'm going to present actually recent work by William and Eric, both in the audience, done over the past year and a half here at Perimeter. And as you see, it combines quantum field theory with quantum Monte Carlo and with holography. So it's been a great collaboration. So this, from the experimental side, this is motivated by this experiment of ultra-cold bosons in an optical lattice, which are now done in two dimensions. And as you vary the depth of the periodic potential, you have a quantum phase transition between a superfluid where the atoms move freely to an insulator where they're trapped. And without proof, I'll just assert that we know that near that critical point between the superfluid and the insulator, all the relevant low-energy excitations are described by a relativistic quantum field theory. It's just the usual five-fold field theory where phi, or in this case psi, has two components. So again, I won't prove it, but there are very strong arguments for the fact, and also a lot of evidence, that if you're close enough to the critical point, you do indeed have a relativistic field theory. All right, so if I now take the language of the relativistic field theory, then there is a phase transition in this field theory between a Goldstone phase with one conventional Goldstone boson and a gap phase where you have only two complex massive particles, two real particles, and here you have one Goldstone boson. But the most interesting point is the point in between them, which is described by what's called the Wilson-Fischer fixed point of a field theory in three space-time dimensions. Let me just briefly flash a recent experiment by the group of Emmanuel Bloch, who take the system and then perturb it periodically at some frequency and look at the response. And by looking at the response in various details that I'd love to go into, but I will not, you can get some idea of the spectrum. And what you find then is that on the left-hand side here, you have these two massive particles when the potential has a minimum at zero, and that's the mod insulator. And on the right-hand side, there's a numbered Goldstone mode going around the inverted Mexican hat, and also a Higgs-like excitation, and they're all seen and have the right behavior as you approach the critical point. So this is rather good evidence that finally there is a very clear-cut realization of a quantum phase transition, which is described by this Wilson-Fischer theory. So as I've said, my interest then is the critical point in between them, which is a strongly interacting critical point. And today we'll say it's an example, the simplest example of a CFT3 of a single complex scalar. Okay, and in this language, in the Wilson-Fischer language, this means that this coupling U goes to some universal fixed point value, and that fixed point interaction not only damps the quasiparticles, it also gives you a universal interaction between whatever the excitations are. Now, if you take this simple phase diagram, I should say that, although of course at some formal level we understand what a CFT3 is much better today than we did at the time of Wilson and Fisher, those traditional methods can allow you to compute just about everything you need to reasonable accuracy in this phase diagram at zero temperature. There's no real problem. You can also put in a Monte Carlo, and I'll show you some Monte Carlo results. And they're all in excellent agreement with each other. So as far as I'm concerned, this is a solved and known problem. Everything here is known, pretty much. So I want to go, so what is there left to do? And well, what's left to do is, of course, the interesting question of what happens when you add a temperature axis. Then that was the zero temperature axis I was talking about. Then you get two broad regimes of dynamics. There are these blue regimes where these conventional particles I just told you about, these number Goldstone bosons and these other excitations, just dominate. And you can use, again, the textbook tools that we have for interactions of these particles, Boltzmann equations, various kinds of Fokker-Planck equations, and so on. And they do an excellent job of describing in some effective classical model of essentially all experiments. So the focus here now is in the pink region in between, where we really have to think about the real-time dynamics of the conformal field theory at finite temperature. And that turns out that's a problem which the traditional methods, as I'll show you, don't work well at all. And there's a deep reason for that. And the deep reason, of course, is that those methods rely at point zero on some quasi-particle basis. They start with a quasi-particle basis, but slowly deform it. That may be okay for some thermodynamic properties, but once you get to real dynamics, it's not okay. And so you really have to think beyond the quasi-particle picture of conventional real-time dynamics. Okay, so that I've kind of said, and we need some new way of thinking about this, and I'll tell you some ideas on that today. All right, so let me first actually quickly review what you do in traditional CMT. So if you're given a complicated system, you solve it at zero temperature, and you figure out the quasi-particle excitation and the dispersion, and you figure out how they interact with each other. And let's say you can do this today, with a high degree of accuracy in something like silicon. And then somebody tells you, well, what's the conductivity of silicon? Well, then you take this very well-defined zero-temperature information, and you put it in the Boltzmann equation. And the Boltzmann equation is some kind of infinite-order resummation of the interaction between the particles. And it gives you nice things like second law of thermodynamics and diffusion and dissipation and so on. And this again also, but it's somewhat an uncontrolled formally approach, but it works really well and successfully in something like silicon. So now let's, for this conformal field here, let's go ahead and do the same thing and show you what happens. So what I want to compute is the conductivity in this region. And I'm going to imagine the bosons have a fake charge E, so my conductivities will be have a factor of E squared in front. But this is something you could, in principle, measure in the experiment by taking your periodic potential and oscillating it in some way. And I think those experiments, hopefully in the next year or two, will come online. So let's just start with the very simplest example of a free CFT3, which is not what's described in the experiment, but let's start from there because the theory starts from that, the Wilson-Fisher theory. So if you compute it, this is what you get. You get a delta function at zero frequency, and this is the quasi-particle delta function. So there are some, when you heat the free CFT, it creates some excitations. Those are just free particles. Then you apply an electric field gradient. Those excitations move in opposite directions, particles and holes, and that gives you a conductivity, infinite conductivity, just flow forever. But at finite frequency, there's some, you can create particle hole pairs out of the vacuum. So when T goes to zero or omega goes to infinity, then you have basically the pair creation amplitude of particles and holes out of the vacuum. And that turns out to be a frequency-independent constant in two space dimensions. And that's a generic property of any CFT3. Yeah.
The chemical potential is zero.
Chemical potential is zero everywhere, yeah.
But why should there be big zero frequency?
This is for a free CFT3. So the moment you put in interactions, this peak will disappear, and you'll get a finite conductivity. So this is particle hole symmetrics, the conformal field theory. There's no chemical potential right now. Okay, so once you put in interaction, so this peak, as you know, you correctly anticipate, this peak is really troublesome. You don't want it there, so you have to get rid of it. But it's there because you started from a free quasi-particle basis. And then I'm going to argue that that's really not a good place to start. So if you put in interaction at next order, and you solve some sort of Boltzmann equation, as we did a long time ago, then you'll find that this becomes finite, but it's still very large because your whole method relies on having small interactions. This U star is the Wilson-Fischer U star. So the scattering probability is U star squared, and that's why this is 1 over the scattering probability, and the width is also about U star. So you get a very singular function of frequency, and the limits of frequency going to zero and epsilon going to zero, whatever your expansion parameter is, don't commute. It's not a uniform limit to low frequency. And that's a problem, and that's an indication of the unsuitability of the quasi-particle approach. But nevertheless, from this structure, you can say a few things. You can say that the conductivity is just some quantum unit of conductance, 26.7 kilo-ohms, or the resistance anyway, times a function of frequency over temperature. And so there's a purely, so this whole function is a property of the CFT. And, you know, major focus of many years of my life, I've been trying to figure out this function. What does this function look like? It's a universal function, which is very measurable, and it's a way of extracting some information of this theory without quasi-particles. But there's no, everything is fully determined here in terms of fundamental constants of nature. So there's a universal characteristic frequency scale, which is just temperature, and the amplitude is just given by E squared over H. Okay, so this is what you would get. All right, so now, suppose let's just carry this through honestly as far as we can. What does this function look like in this quasi-particle expansion? So one particular expansion is a large n limit, a vector large n limit. And over here, you find this function goes to 1/16. So this is a number that any people here have studied CFT3s, you see that all over the place in current correlation functions. Those are computed at zero temperature, which is omega over T going to infinity. And the 2 pi comes in because we measure conductivity in units of E squared over H, not E squared over H bar. So that's the difference between H and H bar is the 2 pi. So this is I wrote it this way because perhaps many of you have seen this 1/16. It's like the Katz-Moody chart of the current algebra. All right, within one lower dimension. However, so that looks fine. I mean, you do the 1 over n expansion here, everything looks perfectly okay. You think you're really doing very well. And you can compute, I think the next order has been computed, but it's all very well controlled. It looks good, as you'll see in a minute. On the other hand, what's happening here is much more delicate. It requires some infinite order resummation and a solution of a quantum Boltzmann equation. And when you do it all, does settle, this is what you get. And the key thing you notice here is this goes to infinity as n goes to infinity, which is the limit where it's valid. And the width of this is about a 1 over n. So as n becomes large, which is where your calculation is valid, this peak becomes really tall and really narrow. And so something highly non-uniform is going on here, because as n becomes large, the quasi-particles are emerging in a theory that didn't have quasi-particles, so which is not a good thing.
Can this resummation be completely controlled?
No, I don't know. That's why I haven't put in, I only put dot, dot, dot. I haven't put in order. I don't, probably it's order 1, but I'm not sure.
So yeah. You're resumming some subclass of diagrams?
Or? Yeah, exactly the class of diagram that Boltzmann told us that we should resum. It's some ladder diagrams of the part. Yeah. If you write down a quantum Boltzmann equation, and I think there are, you can formally justify it, although I think corrections. Well, at n equals infinity, they are quasi-particles. So that's how you're looking at the leading 1/n corrections, and you do that for the kinetic equation. But you're leaving out certain self-energy terms because, you know, those are not supposed to affect transport properties, at least if the interactions are weak. It'd be nice to know how a systematic expansion from the Boltzmann approach for a conformal field theory. We've thought about it a little bit. Yes. But there's still, you know, nu is not exactly. Not one half, so
exactly.
There's still interactions.
That's why I would be worried.
Yeah, so that effect is built in. The fact that nu is one and not one half is built in into that number. So you do include the Hartree corrections to the quasi-particle energy, which is what nu is, but you don't include the eta effects, correct? But I'm pretty sure that whatever the corrections are, they're down by some power of n. Anyway, okay, so, and also now one useful way to present the results is to take the ratio of this value and that value. So this is the value that a particle theorist would have no trouble imagining. This is really real dirty physics of finite temperature and dissipation, and they're different, but they're universal. So what's neat about this is even the dissipative properties of finite temperature are just universal. They're not related to some strange friction coefficient or something. And the ratio is this in the Large N expansion. So you put n equals 2, and that's, say, about 2.6. Okay, just remember that. All right, so this is, as I've kind of reviewing relatively old work in a more modern language here. So the recent advance really comes from many years of work by Eric Sorensen, which he did pioneered studies like this about 10 years ago, and more recently went back to it and did much larger simulation over many months of two different models. Again, there's about 6 transparencies I should show you before I show you this final result, but anyway, so to do full justice to all the analysis that was involved. But let me just say these are two different lattice regularizations of the CFT3. So we know what the CFT is, so we can look at different lattice regularizations. One is in continuous time, the other is in discrete time. But when the dust settles and you compute the same conductivity as a function of frequency over temperature right at the quantum critical point, and you have to really sit at it very accurately, you get the same answer. So that's great. So this is now, however, this is not real frequency, which is what I was using so far. This is the imaginary frequency, and therein lies the rub. This data, even though it looks beautiful, is by no means it's not at all accurate enough to do the analytic continuation to real frequency. But even this took, you know, a state-of-the-art numerical study. So now if you look at this, look at the value at sigma of infinity. That's around 0.36 when you compare that to pi over 8, which is pretty close within 10-20%. So there you're doing very well. So that value, the 1/n expectant, seems to be well behaved, and you're getting a very reasonable value. But if you look at this scale, this is a very blown up scale. This is a relatively small correction, 0.36 to 0.4, you know, 20-30%. And we don't know what is at zero frequency because we don't have access to it in the imaginary time simulation. Barring some real disasters in here, it seems the ratio of sigma of 0 to sigma of infinity is really far from 2.6. You know, it's nowhere near that. It's a much smaller correction, about 20-30%. So that's one indication. Now, this is really the first clear indication from a numerical study that you can't really trust the quasi-particle expansion, so certainly not for n equals 2, which is the case we're interested in.
And how do you know that there isn't some issue with analytic continuation?
Well, I don't really. So this is where it stands. Okay. Yeah. I haven't analytic continued, but it seems to be really far off anyway. Yeah.
In a given simulation, there's a lattice scale, and so the temperature depends a lattice scale.
So this is the 5-6 transparencies I didn't show you. So there's
a limit where it's
Yeah, there's a lot of analysis involved, very careful, and was also done independently by these people, and we all.
Yes, correct. So you can't get any closer to the zero frequency thing, but.
No, so that's one of the, unfortunately, no matter how big your system, because the natural frequency scale is temperature, you can never go below 2 pi T, no matter what. So you can make it as bigger and bigger as you want. All you can do is get more precise points. But that's right. That's no one. So if you could do this in real time, fine. But then there's a sign problem. So that's really the heart of the thing. So this is kind of we're interested in a real time finite temperature property of a CFT3. And that's very, very hard to compute when you don't have a quasi particle basis. That's the heart.
This conductivity is for the SO current in the model.
Yeah, the O2 current. Yeah, it's the O2 current, correct.
And is it a lot harder to go to numerically to go to higher end to see when you start to approach, or is that?
It hasn't been done. I mean, it could be done, I think. Yeah, it shouldn't be that bad. Yeah. All right. Okay. So what I'm going to do, of course, now is so that's the state of the art, how far close we get. Now we're going to apply exactly the same, look at the same data, but with a very different perspective. And that's, of course, the holographic perspective. So the advantage of a holographic perspective is that it never makes any reference to quasi-particle at any time. That's really the key property of it. So how would you do this? So this is the machine you'd want now. So you start with a conformal field theory, and at point zero, you don't have particles. So you can't use this approach. So you need a different recipe. So if you don't have particles, what do you have? Well, what people who study conformal field theory tell us is you have the analogs of particle masses and particle scattering matrix element, and the analogs are scaling dimensions and OPE coefficients of various operators. Those are that's your particle data. So the scaling dimensions, you know, tell you how various operators, two-point correlation function of various operators, this delta A is a set of numbers that you have. And then you can look at more multi-point correlation functions, and what we know from the rules of conformal algebra is that there's only one. And once you know the irreducible three-point vertex, you know everything in principle, at least a finite number of correlators, in terms of these numbers. So these are the analog of the scattering matrix elements, these OPE coefficients. So here again, you know, the Wilson-Fisher fixed point is known well enough that let's say we know all of these numbers. And in principle, if you work hard enough with the computer or your very favorite expansion methods, you can get them. So we know this data. We know the data of the CFT, which defines our closest analog of a particle. But how do we go from this data to the conductivity at finite temperature? That again involves some resummation. And the only method I know of today of doing that is just postulating that is to work in the holographic approach where you have a gravitational theory on anti-de Sitter space. And in principle, then all the coupling constants of your gravitational theory are then related to the OPE coefficient and scaling dimensions of your CFT. Of course, we can't solve this exactly, so we just take a classical approximation. And then in principle, in that classical approximation of classical gravity, everything is known about this theory from the CFT data that you presume you know for your Wilson-Fisher fixed point. But now the magic of ADS of the gravitational theory, which is analog of the magic of the H theorem of the Boltzmann equation, is that when you turn on a finite temperature, you get a horizon of a black hole, and very beautiful theorems of black holes then translate into very beautiful theorems for dynamics of quantum field theories. So in that approach, so when you try to apply this approach, what you find is that, you know, you're trying to compute some current correlation function. What you find is the most important thing is when you turn on temperature is that you get some energy density, thermal energy density. And if you just take this picture of current scattering of something else, so you have the scattering of currents off the stress energy tensor, the thermal stress energy tensor. And that's characterized by some scattering matrix element. It's not that really, it's some very complicated tensor structure, which turns out to be depend on just one coefficient gamma for every CFT3. So every CFT3 has some number of gamma, which you can try to determine. And then there's also an exact bound on gamma that you can get through a variety of ways, going back to work of Hoffman and Maldacena. And in this particular case, that bound is gamma is less than or equal to 1/12. So that's actually a really very important thing, because this is like a free parameter for our CFT, but that parameter can't be too large, bounded by 1/12 in appropriate dimensionless parameterization. Yeah. Yeah, this is all statements about C. A curious fact is that if my next transference, if you now map this onto a theory on ADS4, then it's an Einstein-Maxwell theory. You have a conserved U1 current, so you have it doesn't matter at this stage. Let's just take a U1 current. So you have a U1 gauge field on ADS4. You have the metric. You can think of this Newton constant as being related to the central charge of the theory. This GM, the gauge coupling constant, is related to sigma of infinity, this 1/16 that I talked about. And then gamma is the leading four derivative correction. This is up to four derivatives, these are the only terms that are allowed. And this gamma then is now a coupling constant of gravitational theory. So a curious fact is if you take this gravitational theory and look for self-consistency of the gravitational theory, some positive energy condition, you get exactly the same bound, gamma is 1/12. So, of course, this is a classical gravitational theory, but anyway, so that...
is the Weyl tensor?
That's right, it's the Weyl tensor.
Okay, so you're assuming that somehow there's a truncation that you can stop at that order.
There are four derivatives, correct. So this is not under control, yes. I'm just keeping all terms under four derivatives. Sure. I think William has had some ideas on higher derivative terms, and things do go a bit wild, but let's stop here, yeah.
But also you might have other degrees of freedom, other things.
But you can argue that those don't affect the conductivity, linear conductivity anyway.
Why don't you get some singlet operator multiplying by F squared?
If you have to say, like, take the relevant operator phi squared,
yes.
That has its expectation value at finite temperature CFT is equal to its value at zero temperature. Because that's how you're tuned to be exactly at the critical point. So that leading correction vanishes.
You mean it doesn't get a better?
That's right, it does not. That's right, it doesn't. That's a curious fact. That's because the 5/4 coupling is relevant, and at the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, it doesn't acquire all that.
That's something about some line in your pizza slice, right? As you move across the pizza slice.
Yeah, well, I'm at the critical point.
Yeah.
No, assure me. I assure you, this is correct. Yeah. It comes from the fact, you know, there's a map. If you want to know about this, if you have phi squared, you would think, well, that's just dk, well, d omega 1 over k squared plus omega squared. But when you go to finite temperature, two things happen. This becomes a sum over omega, and you acquire a mass here. And the mass is determined precisely by the condition that this doesn't change. And that has to do with the fact that in this, right at the fixed point, your coupling, self-coupling of the field in some sense is infinite. Phi squared, I cannot fluctuate, otherwise you're including the effect of the leading irrelevant operator. Anyway, so that doesn't acquire a wave. Now, you could, of course, put in some other field that acquires a wave, but there's no natural reason for it.
Well, I mean, I would assume that you turn on finite temperature,
yeah.
Everything in general that can acquire that.
Yes, but the most important operator does not.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Clearly, if you could, like, measure anything, study how it varies as you vary the two.
Yeah, right.
At some fixed finite temperature.
Yeah. But what we're doing, you're sitting at the critical point, and then turning on temperature without changing anything.
Right,
and we want to determine the leading correction.
Right, so you're describing a very particular path in that phase.
Correct, and all other corrections are down by some powers of temperature over the scale of some leading irrelevant operator. I'm certainly not trying to include those. I mean, there's a universal function, but I don't want any irrelevant operators.
Well, I mean, but they could potentially become important in the IR.
they all get BEVs, and the BEVs that they get is aboard a T. So once you approach the horizon, they all blow up at the same time, in principle. Right?
Okay, fine.
Stated in terms of the CFT, there's just a three-point function, and it just has a couple of tensor structures, and gamma is just effectively the coefficient of some tensor structure that's not determined by one entity, right?
I mean, let me put it this way. What I'm doing is I'm integrating out everything else, and this is some effective low-energy theory.
Right.
And I'm just including the leading four derivative term that gives me any correct. I'm integrating out all fields that I had over M. Because the trivial ones. I mean, they're nothing. I'm not breaking any additional symmetries or something. I'm not turning on economic potential. Right. This is not the same N as some matrix N. But we don't know how to do a matrix large N limit for these theories. So this is kind of a guesswork of what it might look like.
The result that you'll get from holography, do you think it's determined just by large N factorization and controlling that?
No. This is uncontrolled. I agree.
Those are uncontrolled assumptions, but if you assume them, will you get the same answer? Imagine you could just plug in the OPE for the stress density for the currents.
I don't know how to. I don't know how to do that calculation. Well, it's some selective I could try to do some perturbation theory in this OPE, and I get the leading term. And this, you can think of this as some infinite resummation of some ladder diagram of those terms. And I'm just arbitrarily doing that. I don't know.
I want you to do that. I want to do that too. But then imagine you compute the thermal expectation value of that thing.
Of what?
Of that quantity, of this leading term in the OPE between the two terms.
Well, this is the only way I know how to do it. Maybe we can do it without using holography. That would be interesting. Yes.
My question is not whether we can do it, but whether the answer is fixed. There's just a definite answer to that question.
There's certainly a definite answer to the DC conductivity, whatever the value is, right? It's just a pure number. And I'm just trying to get some estimates of that number. Yes.
So why can't I put Riemann there? Why does it have to be the Y tensor?
So there's Rob here, help me out, but there's a variety of terms there. By various parameterization, you can remove most all of them except this one. And there's about five or six terms, and those other terms do matter if you're doing nonlinear effects, but if you're doing just linear transport, just infinitesimal electric field, this is the only one that matters.
I see. If you're doing linear transport, then you're probably saying that the rest can be just reabsorbed into F squared, the original.
Yes.
Linear means you're perturbing around anti de Sitter space, or what?
Yes.
Geometry?
Yeah, it's not. Well, it's thermal anti de Sitter. There's some thermal geometry,
right.
And it's linear in the electric field. You're just looking at the 2-point current correlation function in a pure thermal ADS geometry, correct?
Does the horizon have a charge?
No. There's no charge. Once you put in charge, yes, then you can. Then it's. What I can tell you is that I have spent a very enjoyable several months where I actually computed this in full glory of the four indices. There are 157 terms. And I can assure you they exactly match the 157 terms you get from this term. So it works. It does reproduce the full structure of the 3-point correlator. It's just a way of teaching myself how to do all this. But yeah.
I mean, using symmetries and worded, I would have thought that there would be far fewer than 157.
Well, I was using the most. I wasn't even using the helicity. I couldn't understand the helicity formalism, so I just divided in Lorentz indices. But I'm sure if you use the fancy helicity projections, this could be done in a few minutes. Maybe somebody will teach me how to do that, and then. This is the hypothesis, and let's see how it works. And as you'll see, in some ways it works extremely well, but there are some problems, and maybe this is related to some of the issues you're raising, and we'd love to figure out how to improve this. So this is another theory. Now, this theory has some very, very nice properties. One of the very nice properties of this theory is that if you take this function sigma, which was just, you just pulled out this factor E squared over H, and you compute it for this theory or really any holographic theory, they satisfy these two sum rules. So the first sum rules kind of seems something you might have expected, even though it's quite non-trivial and wasn't written down until the last couple of years ago. That's like the F sum rule. The integral on the conductivity is fixed, but you do have to subtract the infinite value here. And so this is any CFT should obey this. This is a much more non-trivial sum rule, and it follows from the fact that if you have a U1 charge, anyway, in any CFT, there's another CFT, S dual CFT, that you can define holographically anyway, for which the conductivity will be the inverse of the conductivity. So that other CFT should also satisfy the same sum rule. So you get another sum rule for the inverse of the conductivity. And that's highly non-trivial. So whatever result you get should obey these sum rules, will obey these sum rules, and we believe those are exact properties of any CFT3.
Including the second one?
Yes, yes. With the conserved U1 anyway. With the ON, it may be
outside the large N.
I believe it's beyond large N, yes.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, there's a paper by Witten where he defines these things. Yeah, no, it is the inverse. It's the exact inverse. Yes. That's an exact result. Yeah. Now, the Boltzmann theory does not obey the second sum rule, so it violates one exact property. Related to this, there's also a fact that this function of response function. So, as a function in the complex plane, it should poles be in the lower half plane. That's not so surprising, but because of this property, even the zeros have to be the lower half plane, because its inverse is also a reasonable conductivity of some other system. And that again, so these two properties are not obeyed by the large N expansion. So that's a beautiful thing about the CFT3 is that it, of the holographic method, that these exact results are all built in. Well, it works for this one, but not this one.
So where does it?
Well, the duality, I don't know how to define the duality for ON currents, only for O2 currents.
But I want to say is that the Boltzmann theory is controllable when you have a large N vector.
Yeah, but for ON models, I don't know how to define the dual. The dual is only for a billion symmetries. Maybe. But then you won't get back something that has the full ON symmetry. You can take an ON model and take a U, you'll get some quiver models in the dual. It becomes, it has many different gauge fields. It becomes very complicated. So that's another very curious property. Okay. So finally, let's take this theory, and from our perspective now, this theory has one free parameter, gamma, which is bounded by 1/12, and this is what you get for sigma of omega over sigma of infinity. And in fact, this ratio is 1 plus 4 gamma, and gamma is less than 1/12, so that correction is never more than 1/3. So that's good, because we put in some higher order correction, and it doesn't change things too much. So if you had gamma equals 0, that means you only had the Einstein-Maxwell theory, you get constant. This was an old result with Damson. When you put in this term, then you get a bounded correction. So this up to all possible four derivatives, there's a bounded correction. So now we can compare this with this result that we obtained in Monte Carlo. And of course, in the holographic theory, there's no problem working in Euclidean time. We can do it in Euclidean time also. And so this is now the comparison between the holographic theory, which actually is this dashed line, I should say, and the Monte Carlo. Now, if you give us the freedom, and this is the one part that doesn't work, and I'd love to understand better why it doesn't. If you give us the freedom to rescale this axis. So we think of that as rescaling temperature for the dynamical property. So there's some kind of rescaling between the thermodynamic temperature and the dynamic temperature. So if you just rescale it, you get the green line. And beautifully, gamma comes out to be just below 1/12. So gamma 1/12 is 0.083. So it's right near the bound. If this had come out to be 10, I'd give up the whole thing. it seems to be right in the right ballpark. So now I have some theory, or at least I have a function which obeys all the sum rules, which also fits the data on the imaginary axis. It's already quite a non-trivial thing. It has all the right analytic properties. So I take this function that I get from solving these differential equations, which has been fit in the complex frequency plane on this axis, and then analytically continue to the real axis. So then I have finally a prediction for the experiments, and this is the only way of getting this prediction so far. There's nothing I can check it against because there's no other method for computing this quantity. And that's that blue line in complete absolute units of the conductivity. So that's where it stands. Yes. So we've done the n equals infinity computation, and in the proper basis, you get 1/12 at n equals infinity. Yes. The 1 over n corrections we've been staring at, but I think we need some more expertise in conformal field theories to do that. I think it's doable. It's probably a piece of cake for an expert in conformal field theories. From the way Zohar was talking, he could probably do it immediately. I don't know if he's here. But yeah, we are just learning those tricks. Okay, so that's where it is. I mean, this is now maybe it'll be tested against experiments. As I said, even in the theory, there's some very nice things. You know, you're getting this 33% correction, which is, you know, right in the ballpark of what the Monte Carlo suggests, and very far from what the Boltzmann equation was giving you, which is more like a factor of 2.5 or 3. And all these new sum rules are obeyed. And the value of gamma comes out to be right where we expected it to be. The only fly in the ointment is this rescaling that we don't understand. And we thought about it, but you know, I think some new ideas are needed too. Clearly we're leaving out something, and I'm not quite sure what. And hopefully we can repair this without doing the full quantum gravitational theory. Yeah.
Is one overall constant scale of the temperature is needed?
Yes, yes, yeah.
This involves what's the right way to match the time of the theory to the time of the CFT?
Well, it's just, so the temperature is determined by the horizon. So the temperature determines, for example, the entropy density.
It's determined once you know that and normalize the killing vector.
Yes. Right.
Look for is where is the time of the CFT being tied to the time of the ADS, which is an ambiguous thing on the ADS side. So I can easily imagine the slippery idea about how you should be normalizing the time according to the ADS.
Well, so the point is that it's hard to get around it because, you know, there's a horizon. So the horizon has a periodicity in imaginary time, which is determined by temperature.
But it's not well-defined. Yeah.
Okay, so
temperature periodicity
yeah.
But if you try to make that dimensionable, it's ambiguous.
Yeah, okay. But then that same temperature also determines thermodynamic property, like the entropy density.
Yeah.
Now, you know, so, and you're always measuring frequency in units of that periodic time on the horizon. So you don't really, this horizontal axis is basically the dimension, it's an integer in imaginary time. You don't have that much freedom to play with it, unfortunately. So it must be somehow that the temperature, I mean, the horizon does two things in ADS. One, it determines the periodicity of imaginary time. The other, it also determines the entropy. And the two are really linked. Now, maybe the entropy, there's some, I can imagine that the entropy that appears has some other anomalies. Corrections. Yeah. Yeah, but that's okay. Well, at least in classical gravity. But if you include some quantum corrections, maybe there are corrections there. Okay. Well, I wanted to mention this because I'm hoping the experts can solve this problem. We've been over it over many times, and we haven't come up with any satisfactory solution. Yeah, so this curve is just obtained by solving this equation. I mean, solving the classical Einstein-Maxwell's equation of this theory.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's all. So, you know, it's uncontrolled, but as I said, it's physical in the sense that it doesn't assume quasi-particles. It doesn't, it obeys all the right sum rules. And it's systematic in some sense, in the gradient expansion. So even the Boltzmann equation is uncontrolled, so it's not such a bad thing to do such things.
The number of parameters it took to specify the two-point and three-point correlators, CFT, that sort of matches the parameter count.
Yes. So you have a current, which has a two-point correlation function. So the current is, J of X. Is some constant K over X, X fourth or something with some tensor structure. Okay, so this constant in appropriate units is 1/16 at an equal infinity. So that constant fixes this dimensionless charge in four dimensions. Then there's the gravitational constant, which is related to the central charge of the two-point correlator of the stress energy tensor. And then you compute this three-point correlator. And what you find is a very complicated tensor structure. For any CFT, this was done by, in the old days, by, what's his name? Petkuh and Osborne. And they showed that there was one free parameter with a very complicated three-point correlation function. And if you put this in and compute it gravitationally, you can reproduce the general form. And so that's the one parameter left over. And then the recent work of Hoffman and Maldacena and various extensions, they were in one higher dimension, they were in ADS 5, gives you these bounds. And that's really key. And very curiously, you get the same bound by just consistency of this gravitational theory. Exactly the same bound, although one is more exact than the other. This is just a classical gravitational approximation. Okay, I've only finished 40% of my talk, and I have 5 minutes left, maybe. But anyway, this is the part I wanted to talk about. So, any other questions on this part? Yeah.
You don't have an epsilon tail in the afternoon.
I don't have what?
You don't have an epsilon.
Yeah. So I'm assuming parity. Yeah. I am assuming. Sure. So. Right. So. Absolutely. So all of this can be extended to including an FF dual term and a Chern-Simons term in the field theory. Those CFTs correspond to phase transitions between different quantum Hall plateaus of particles in a lattice. And we don't have any such experiments. But everything I've said applies also there. I mean, in the whole quantum Hall game also, there's just this many papers computing conductivity at the critical point between quantum Hall plateau. What they're all computing is this K and not the sigma of zero. The actual physical conductivity is a much more complicated object, which the same story can be applied there. I have a couple of papers, at least in the field theory side, where I've done that. But yeah, it's easily extended to include the FF dual. Maybe, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You said there is a matrix M here.
I didn't write it out, but that's in the back of my mind. That's what I'm imagining.
When n equal to 2, do you get the U1?
Sure. I mean, I can just take my complex field and give it two indices, and then put n equals 1 in those indices. Yeah. So there's a very natural matrix generalization of these models, of which we know nothing really, in the matrix large n limit. What's another way to say it is that what's good about that? So there's two different large n limits, and if you look at this particular vector large n limit, there's this frequency scale, or which you can think of as some kind of equilibration time, which is the inverse of this frequency. So in these systems, the thermal equilibration time, the local equilibration time, is kT times n. So n goes to infinity, that time goes to infinity. So you don't have any control for how, you know, what's happening at that time, at least good control of the full crossover. For the matrix large n limit, as far as we know, this factor of n is not present. The local equilibration time is just kt times the number of order 1 in the matrix large n limit. That's the key advantage of the holographic slash matrix approaches.
And you can't carry this vector large n to the holographic
language. You could, but it doesn't buy you anything. Well, it gives you these higher spin gauge theories, which are beautiful, but they give me nothing new. I mean, I everything you could compute with the higher spin gauge theory, I can compute much more simply by these methods. but the matrix large n is giving me something, some new physics. Yeah. Believe me, I'm talking to them. They're getting there. You know, experimentalists have a mind of their own. They want to do something. They do things when it's right for them, and then they suddenly realize, oh, this is so interesting, even though I've been telling them that for 10 years. But eventually, they'll come out. You know, no, I'm just joking, but you know, I'm sure there's many complicated issues they have to sort out before they can believe their results for the conductivity. But I've told this to Emmanuel enough times that he's thinking about it. But they get distracted by something, you know, some cool entanglement thing they can suddenly measure, and then, you know, what can I do? But they're learning about CFTs, and they're starting to like CFTs, so let's see. All right, well, in 3 minutes, okay, let me just say a few things about the next part. All I say is that there's now a great deal of evidence that there is another strongly coupled field theory in two space dimensions, which is not a CFT and which is not relativistic. And that's something to celebrate because there really were no examples before. I'm just going to go through two or three slides. This is work with Max. So where does it appear? It appears in the context of you start with the Fermi liquid, and it appears in other contexts too, but this is one context. And the Fermi liquid undergoes what's called the Pomeranchuk instability, where the Fermi surface distorts either in the x or the y direction. We're assuming there's some square lattice here. So you can write down a theory for this, where you have some Ising autoparameter, which has the usual Wilson-Fischer action. And then you have a Fermi surface for the electrons. And then there's some Yukawa coupling dictated by symmetry between the electrons and the boson. So this is very much like some gross Naveau model that has been discussed earlier for graphene. The main difference is that these are not Dirac fermions. These are fermions of the Fermi surface. So this is not really a field theory because it's got all these large momenta floating around. But I think we've finally managed to figure out how to write this as a field theory. What you do is you imagine that there's some boson with momentum q, and it's easy to imagine that the fermions that will react most strongly to this boson are fermions which are tangent to the Fermi surface when you go in this direction. So these are two fermions, psi plus and psi minus, and then you just expand this fermion about k0, the boson about this point, and this fermion about minus k0. And you get this field theory. So that's a very simple-looking field theory. It's got this very anisotropic dispersion, x in one direction, and linear in this direction, and quadratic in the other direction. This ordinary Yukawa coupling, and some gradients. And this turns out to be a very strongly coupled field theory, where large n expansions break down, but Sung-sik has some beautiful new sets of expansions for them, and a lot of work's been done. I can't possibly do justice to it, but we're starting to know more and more about this, and there's probably also a holographic dual, and there's many interesting constraints that are satisfied by the holographic dual. So that's all I'm going to say, and I'm going to jump ahead. You give me 10 minutes, I can talk about it. Well, I mean, these hyperscaling violating metrics, I know, okay. But there are many properties of the entropy and the entanglement entropy and the Luttinger theorem that are all satisfied for one particular value of theta. In in very beautiful ways that makes me think it's not an accident. That's all I have to say. So let me just put in the main. So basically, I talked about one canonical and really very interesting example of a system without quasi-particles. And this has been realized in experiments. And hopefully, there are going to be even more tests about our somewhat adventurous combining of quantum Monte Carlo and holography. I didn't tell you about metallic states, but there's a lot of fun there, too. Thank you.